Hey everyone, you're listening to Green Visions here on KUMD, Duluth Public Radio. In a very special edition of Green Visions, we're taking a look at the concept of energy democracy in the 21st century. As we move towards the inevitable integration of renewables into our energy mix, an opportunity for greater participation of communities and individuals has been created. This concept has implications into the way that energy is produced and what it might do to benefit local communities. To help us better understand these concepts, we're going to be looking towards Germany as our key example. Germany has been very successful over the past several decades in transitioning its energy mix towards renewables while expanding citizen participation through community-based projects. As a result, nearly 50% of Germany's renewable energy sector is owned by farmers and citizens participating in collective community-based development. By better understanding the challenges and accomplishments of the German energy transition, we hope to provide insight into the potential future of an American Energiewende. In this episode, we'll be talking to Craig Morris, co-author of Energy Democracy, a book which really lays out the history of Germany's energy transition. Craig, who was born in the United States and now lives in Germany, helps us better understand some of the potential benefits of implementing community projects.
And what I think the country needs, and this is for energy, but it's also really healing the gap that we, I think, all acknowledge exists right now in the U.S., what we need is really a focus on the thing in the middle, between individuals and the national level, and that's strengthening communities, bringing different people together, different groups of people together, and finding what they can do as one unit.
We'll also talk to Anya Schulman, Executive Director of Solar United Neighbors. Anya provides insight into renewable energy development in the United States and potential inroads to expanding citizen participation.
But you do have to educate people as to how easy it is. It's a very simple technology. It's very safe. It's cost effective.
We conclude with Josef Pesch, CEO of FESA, an energy co-op in Freiburg, Germany. Josef, a German citizen, has been involved in community-focused renewable energy for nearly 40 years and provides, through personal experience, insight into the potential of community-focused models, as well as motivation for U.S. citizens to create their own Energiewende.
We are now producing 40% of our energy from renewables, and we could, if we wanted to, it's not a technical problem anymore, if we really wanted to, by 2030, we could do 100%. And that is perhaps the message to the state. You can do it. What is stopping you? If you have a roof, what is stopping you?
I'm Adam Reinhart, and this is Green Visions. As promised, we begin our investigation with Craig Morris. Craig is the author of a book called Energy Democracy, which is really the first comprehensive history of Germany's energy transition. Craig starts by describing what exactly the Energiewende is.
Germany's energy transition, which it has a name, it's called Energiewende. It basically is a goal of decarbonizing the energy sector, decarbonizing the economy by mid-century. And it started off, this is the thing that makes it really special, it started off as a grassroots movement in the 1970s.
And that all really started in Wiel, Germany, right? In that the southwestern part of the country, right along the border of France, with those anti-nuclear protests.
Exactly. Well, it was anti-nuclear protests, But the protests that took place, and that's kind of why our book is called Energy Democracy, they initially did not focus on radioactivity. This was a rural farming community that didn't really understand the threat of radioactivity. They basically were protesting plans to industrialize their basically thriving farming community.
The exact percentage might have changed a little bit recently here, but you know, at one point, 50% of the renewable energy produced in Germany was produced, at least in some capacity, by individuals and communities, farmers. 50%, I mean, the idea, especially from an American perspective, of a country's energy mix being produced, you know, with so much citizen involvement is really shocking and exciting. So how is that possible in Germany? How have they been able to capture, you know, to the title of your book, this energy democracy? What incentives exist there?
Right. It's individuals and mostly groups, actually. So, communities coming together to put up, recover local biomass and use that for electricity and heat. An individual can put up a solar roof, but you can't afford, a giant wind turbine today. A single one of them costs a few million. But a community can come together and do that, and that's what's happened over here. And we've had a policy in place to promote that. It basically means that the utility, that your local utility that doesn't want you as a competitor, they want you as a customer. The German law says that they don't get to pick the price that you're going to get paid for your electricity. So they try to set a fair price, a floor price, that the utility has to offer you for your green electricity. And this means that basically a much wider range of participants have entered the German market than we might see in most parts of the U.S.
So when the German government set that floor price, that fair price for the energy that the utility has to buy from the citizens producing it, it basically made it a profitable investment for someone to get involved in renewables?
Well, again, it's individuals, but it's also really communities. I really have to stress that. Mm-hmm. That's the thing that I personally feel is missing the most in the U.S. In fact, I just tweeted something to this extent while I was waiting for this call. Basically, in the U.S., we talk about national issues like national energy security, and then we talk about individual rights. And what I think the country needs, and this is for energy, but it's also really healing the gap that we, I think, all acknowledge exists right now in the U.S. What we need is really a focus on the thing in the middle, between individuals and the national level, and that's strengthening communities, bringing different people together, different groups of people together, and finding what they can do as one unit. And if we begin to reach across the aisle like that and say, what would be good, for our community? What if our town began to make its own energy, our neighborhood? Then that would also, not only bring more people into the energy market, but bring people of different walks of life together, doing things productively and getting to know each other.
Absolutely. Is there a reason behind that social cohesion in Germany in particular? Is it just a historical thing or something that is kind of sprouted from this grassroots movement that started the whole deal? Why is it in Germany that there is that community tie, at least in your opinion?
Well, there are certain things about Germany politically and historically and culturally. We describe some of these in our book. But I don't want to overstate that case. I know that a lot of the time in the U.S. debate, We have people saying, yes, you can have socialism in Scandinavia because those people all look the same. Germany has a very large immigrant population. You'd be surprised, okay? We have no internal borders in the EU anymore, so the Spanish, the Italians, the Eastern Europeans can come over here in any number they want and just set up shop. So we have quite a large influx of foreigners, and of course I live here, so Americans can come over.
Yeah.
So we have those options, but what really makes Germany different from the U.S., I think, is a political focus and a cultural background that focuses on finding a consensus. So the democracy here is not set up on a winner-take-all basis. It's set up on a coalition basis, which means that the political parties view each other, and we have more than two, but they view each other not as enemies but as potential future partners in a coalition. And then there's also various things from history, like the Hanseatic League, which was a bunch of cities up in sort of in the North Sea, not just in Germany but in England and Scandinavia as well. But it was a decentralized kind of loose self-governing body of trading cities, okay? And so they didn't have a central government, so to speak. They basically had to just take it on trust, build up trust and confidence in each other. And there's other examples I could go into, but you get the idea. We have a history here and a culture here of trying to not force something through, but actually get the other side to say, all right, fine, we'll reach a compromise and move forward.
Absolutely. Sort of along those lines as well, the Green Party, who holds power in that region where Veale took, or the protests in Veale took place, that region is conservative in a lot of ways. Is that correct?
We actually flipped in southwest Germany from the Christian Democrats straight to the Greens. And you might think, okay, they flipped from right to left. But actually, the governor of the state, it's called a minister president, not a governor, but it's essentially that. He basically is a church-going man who is quite conservative, and we have for instance, the city of Freiburg, we have a mayor who, for the longest time, he's also a Green, but he has had a coalition with the Christian Democrats, and so that's really kind of the magic to the Green Party's success over here, is that they have found a way to also, at times, be an umbrella unit. And bring in a broad spectrum of the population.
Conservatives in Germany aren't necessarily opposed to environmentalism. In a lot of ways, they see environmentalism as part of the conservative ideology. Is that fair to say? Is the idea that
exactly.
they...
Exactly. I always like to say that the word conserve is in both of the words conservationist and conservative.
Sure.
So actually, historically speaking... It shouldn't be surprising that conservatives can be conservationists. The real question is, why have we lost that so much in the United States?
And so a German with conservative values might be opposed to a wind turbine, not because they're opposed to renewables, but because they're opposed to their 300-year-old farm plot having a large wind turbine in the backyard, sort of disturbing their view.
Yeah, you might have some heritage protection issues. You know, a solar roof maybe. If there's a historic building, people might say, well, that's not really the way that building is supposed to look.
Mm-hmm.
But you could also have the opposite. I mean, farmers tend to look at the land not as something to that is pristine and shouldn't be changed, but as something they have to live off of. So you have these competing kind of visions and. Ways of appreciating the land. You know, people from the city who move out to the countryside go there because they want to have this pristine nature experience, whereas the farmer might want to be able to have a livelihood.
Sure.
And so the farmer might actually like a wind turbine on his farm, around the crops and everything.
In many ways, it's inevitable that this integration of renewables will just continue to grow as the price of renewables meet market parity with more traditional sources of fuel like fossil fuels. How does this global energy transition, moving away from fossil fuels into these newer technologies, represent an opportunity for community members, communities as a whole, to recapture their energy democracy?
Right. So I do think that renewables are coming one way or the other. The business case is increasingly there. I don't think that's going to really be the issue. What we're trying to sort of point out to people in our book, and this is also what I realize every time I go home, is that, you know, my relatives in the U.S., and they basically all voted for Trump, what they basically complain about in rural America, flyover America, is nobody cares about us in the big city. The decision makers are not listening to us. We don't have a choice with our utility. We don't have a choice with our internet provider. And what they want is business opportunities, local business opportunities, and they want to have input into decision-making processes, and they want to be respected by the suits and ties in the big city. And that's actually what we've gotten over here in Germany with some of these renewable energy projects in rural areas.
You know, is there a facet of the German energy transition that we as Americans could take with us back across the pond? And apply to our own energy transition, our own Energiewende. You know, what motivated them, and what was successful, what worked?
Well, I think if I were to address now the sort of the climate hawk audience, you know, the people who are definitely concerned about the climate, who might be listening, There is a big debate there about should we be positive or negative? Should we try to scare people with these awful visions of climate change, or should we say just positive things so that people are motivated to get involved? And what I have learned from talking to people over here in Germany about why they became involved in their community energy projects is one sentence that has been repeated several times. It's that the people who got involved wanted to basically save their communities first and the planet second. And so you can motivate people regardless of whether you use positive or negative images and motivation. You motivate them mainly by helping improve their immediate lives, but not just their personal lives, their communities. People want to live in prospering, safe communities. They want to know their neighbors. They don't want to lead lonely lives. And we can tap into those energies in the U.S. the way we have done in Germany, and we will also get climate change mitigation in the process.
So really building from the base there with that community focus, all the while addressing climate change with these community-focused renewable energy models. I have one more question for you here, Craig. You know, is an American energy vendor possible? Is a community-focused energy transition achievable in the United States? And if we want to see that happen, what would be the first step?
I think we already have a discussion in the U.S. about, you know, do I have the right to have a solar roof, for instance?
Sure.
We can continue to have that discussion, but I would encourage Americans to start reaching out to their neighbors, start building community energy projects, and demanding those rights as well. You know, come together in your neighborhood, invite your neighbors to a meeting about these things, get to know your neighbors, and start talking to them about things that you can do with them together. Go to City Hall, you know, if it's bigger than a neighborhood, go to City Hall and start demanding these discussions. What can my city do? What can citizens in my city do? That's the discussion we need to be having.
That was Craig Morris, co-author of Energy Democracy. What's apparent from my conversation with Craig is that renewable energy, specifically in this community framework, not only provides a chance to address some of the serious environmental challenges that we face today, it is also an opportunity to bring together people who may have otherwise not interacted. And I think the value of that cannot be understated today. It seems that these community projects not only provide economic opportunities, jobs, and the clearest path to reducing carbon emissions from energy production, it also provides a chance for people of different worldviews to come together and do something positive. Next, we talk to Anya Schulman, Executive Director of Solar United Neighbors. Anya has been involved in renewable energy integration in the United States for many years and shares with us key factors and potential limitations in expanding citizen participation in renewables.
My name is Anya Schulman. I'm the Executive Director of Solar United Neighbors.
Well, thank you so much, Anna, for joining us. What we're looking at is the idea of energy democracy and this concept of community-based renewable energy development. When you get down to the brass tacks, what's that about?
Well, I think it gets down to, in some ways, a very simple idea, which is that not only do people want to have a transition to clean energy because of all the reasons we already know about, the most important being climate change and health and air pollution and protecting the environment, energy independence, et cetera. But people also want to get an economic benefit from that transition. So people want to own solar, not rent solar, or they want to develop projects themselves or develop new companies in their community or have control and have benefits shared locally, as opposed to sort of the old idea about energy, which is some giant monopoly, completely owns everything, and the role of the homeowner or the ratepayer was just, you know, pay the bill, whatever they tell you to pay, that's what you need to do to keep the lights on.
So, Anya, these community-based projects have been a huge success in areas like Germany. What's needed in the United States to make them equally so?
Well, I mean, the first is just information. So most people in America don't yet realize that today they can make their own solar power less expensively than they can buy it. So you can make your own power for cheap. And part of that is because you got to pay up front. So, you know, with traditional energy, you pay as you use it, so it's spread out. But with solar, you pay all up front to buy the equipment. So it seems like a lot of money, but once you understand how that's spread out, it's actually cheaper energy. So information is definitely the first step.
How do you make solar equitable for lower income communities as you're building in this community aspect of it? If a resident didn't have that initial down payment that's required for the actual installment of the panels, how do you make it so that this community development benefits more than just people that can afford panels?
That's a great question. I mean, the first thing you got to do is you got to start talking about it. So, and people have to realize in the transition to clean energy that when you put things into the rates, into the electric bills, it's actually a regressive way of paying for something. And by regressive, I mean that it impacts the poorest people the most in terms of a percentage or the how it's felt. And that's the opposite of, say, income tax, where the more money you make, the more you pay. So one of the things that the environmental community needs to be very aware of is how new renewable energy is getting paid for, and if it's going to be embedded into rates, what are the impacts? So the way we work on it is we start to talk from the very beginning about energy and access, equity and access. So it's not just that we have clean energy, but that there's access. You've got to talk about it. And that is the very first step. And then there's a whole lot of really interesting programs that once you consensus that that's important, that it's part of the goal, that both governments and utilities can and communities can do. So there's financing. We've seen in a bunch of locations where the utility itself will finance low-income solar. That's one example. Another are grant programs where, for example, the program that we run in Washington, D.C., where they take a little bit of a, you know, I think it's 20 cents a bill each month goes to a renewable energy fund, and then that adds up to $20 million a year, which is spent on low-income solar. And so if you have a low enough income, you get a free solar system. So there's many, many, many creative models. And almost every there's probably a new interesting model happening in every state in the United States. But the challenge is to get enough people excited about them and build support for the programs so that they scale.
And how do you express, is it just through education that you express to people the value of creating your own energy? I don't think the average person might really understand the benefits associated with that.
Well, it's remarkable because I've talked in literally thousands of public meetings and in every different kind of situation you can imagine, downtown Washington, D.C., rural West Virginia, all kinds of different, you know, political environment, culture. And people generally get it. People really love the idea of making their own power, having that independence, self-sufficiency, and then the sort of clean and local and the local jobs. So you don't have to really educate people about why it's a great idea, but you do have to educate people as to how easy it is. It's a very simple technology. It's very safe. It's cost effective. And so then the big challenge is just getting people over the hump. People are busy. And that's why our work is really focused to making it easier for people to go solar. So we're, what we really are addressing is that information gap and then the I don't have time to deal with it gap, which God knows, you know, many of us are working two jobs, raising families, and people just don't have time to get to it.
touching back on what we were talking about earlier, Germany's had this really successful transition. Are there any lessons that we can learn from what they did and any insight into why maybe they have done it so successfully, relatively speaking?
Well, I mean, I actually took a trip to Germany to study the energy there and what they were doing. And for me, the most important takeaway is that the more people that benefit from the clean energy transition, the broader and more diverse the support for the transition. And it's that simple. You know, people support stuff that benefits them. That's not a negative thing. That's self-interest, and that's normal. And what Germany's been able to do is really spread out the benefits so that rural farmers can host renewable energy systems, and they can benefit from it. Community members can get together and they can, you know, put solar on their soccer stadium and create a shade over the bleachers and make electricity. Everyone in Germany has access to put their renewable energy on the grid, and that really eliminates some of the big, one of the big barriers that you often see in the United States, where each state and each utility and each municipality have their own permits, their own interconnection, and their own rules. I don't think, you know, Germany is, you know, much more centrally organized than the United States, but, you know, the efforts that they've made to make sure that anybody who wants to do a project, they can have access, and that the permits and the rules are very simple and streamlined, really makes a difference.
I had a conversation with Craig Morris, who authored a book about the Energiewende in Germany. And a big aspect of what he talked about was how it kind of brought communities together, and they met people where they were and sort of built this community project that in a lot of ways he felt would help address some of the barriers in the United States between community members and sort of work as a community building project. Do you see that as well in your experience engaging with projects in the United States? Have community projects built or sort of brought people together in those communities?
I think it depends. You know, I don't think that you could say, we definitely participated in and supported a number of community projects where that's been the case. And certainly the work that even that we're doing with residential solar, where we're organizing these co-ops, that's the fundamental premise. So we get a group of people together. We usually work with a community partner, whether that's a government agency or a church or a citizen group, and we all come together and people learn about solar. And they also, you know, have this incredible sense of satisfaction because in 8 months, a whole bunch of people get solar. And then they meet each other, and then they usually as an agenda for future action. So after they get solar in their own home, then they might start becoming advocates for low-income solar or for doing a project on the school or the library. And it doesn't stop. We often say going solar on your own roof is the beginning, not the end of the process. So I've definitely seen that. But I also think that the difference between Germany and the U.S. it's that there's a lot of rules that make it hard for people to do the kind of projects that get done in Germany. It's hard to do collective ownership. It's hard to get access and interconnection and permitting and things like that. And the other thing is that we also see renewable energy sometimes become a divisive issue where, for example, there might be an issue of, like, what's the right way to use the land? Is it for wind or solar, or is it for agriculture? And you might even have farmers who are neighbors on different sides of the issues. So what I would say is, I'm sorry, this is such a long answer, but it's complicated, and it can be a really amazing tool to unite and build community, but it's not inherently so. And you definitely see examples of both in the U.S.
Before we get going here, if there was one thing that you wish, or you know, maybe it is that regulation change, but what is needed in the U.S. at least to get the ball, to continue that ball rolling towards these more community-oriented energy development projects?
I mean, in some ways, the most fundamental thing is there should be no limit in terms of size or quantity on people's ability or right to make their own power for themselves. And so what you see in most states is there is caps in very small numbers, 1%, 2% on the total amount. They call it net metered solar. And it basically says once we get to 2%, the whole program is done and nobody after that can do rooftop solar. And with a limit like that, it really, you know, it makes people feel like, why bother in a way? So I think the most important thing is that it should be an absolute right to net meter, which means you get to offset your usage with your amount of production on a one-to-one basis. And it should be an absolute right in a community or a state or a locality to do as much of this at any size. So if you want a big warehouse, you should be able to do it, or a big box store, or a little tiny cabin. Anybody should be able to do it. And the utility, which fundamentally has a conflict of interest because they're trying to sell more energy, shouldn't be allowed to stop you. It should be the utility's job to integrate all that energy into the mix, not slow it down.
That was Anya Schulman, Executive Director of Solar United Neighbors. I thought it would be valuable to bring in an American perspective to see where the differences in potential opportunities for advancement exist between the German system and the American system. What's apparent from our conversation is that there's definitely some differences in access, interconnection, the permitting process that seem to discourage the community-based development that seems so prolific in Germany. For our final interview, we're going to talk with Josef Pesch. Josef is a German citizen who's been involved with community renewable energy development for many years. My hope is that by bringing in a German citizen, we can gain a greater perspective on some of the benefits and maybe some encouragement to creating our own energy transition.
My name is Josef Pesch. I've been involved in renewable energies for about 40 years. Largely in community projects. I helped set up the German Wind Energy Association years and years and years ago as a student. And I'm now the CEO of an energy co-op in Freiburg.
Tell us a little bit about the co-op that you work with.
Well, the co-op is the latest in a series of developments. We started out as an association in the 90s to do solar projects. And community solar projects. And the first one we did was 100K on the stadium roof of the local soccer club that had just gotten into the Premier League at the time. And so we installed about 100K on that. I think it was one of the first community solar projects we had in Germany.
In your experience, what excites these German residents about creating their own energy?
Well, first of all, of course, when we started out in the 80s and early 90s doing renewable energies, there was no other opportunity. There were no investors as such. There was no companies interested in investing. Of course, that has changed massively. So the only way you could get a project going, if you didn't have lots of money, and of course most of us didn't, was to find fellow like-minded people who would also chip in a few euro or D-mark or bucks or whatever to get the project off the ground. Without equity, simply you can't do projects.
So part of the community buy-in aspect of it, at least initially, was out of necessity. So, Josef, who are really the first people in Germany to install a wind turbine or solar panel? And what mechanisms have allowed so many other citizens of Germany to also participate in this renewable energy integration?
Of course, in the beginning, it was mostly farmers in northern Germany who had perhaps built a small wind turbine on their land to produce energy for their farm mostly. But in 1990, of course, we had, I think, the most important piece of legislation we've seen in Germany. It's two pages of feed-in tariff law that has, in fact, is the basis of an industrial revolution that is turning the energy and particularly the electricity market right round here. Of course, when we started out, all the big utilities were just laughing at us. They stopped laughing somewhere in the mid-90s. At the moment, of course, they're struggling because by now we have about 40% of renewables in the German system. And most of that renewable energy is produced not by the utilities. They only have about 8% or so share of renewables in Germany. The rest, in some way or another, is funded by the people.
I think it's worth stopping for a minute and just thinking about that. Renewable energies make up almost 40% of the German energy mix. And on January 1st of 2018, for a brief moment, 100% of the electrical demand in Germany was satisfied by the renewables they have on the grid. And as Josef was saying, most of that is produced, at least in some capacity, by citizens. There's some really interesting graphs and charts that really lay it all out. And I think it's worth a quick internet search because the ownership of this renewable energy is just so diverse. It's a pie, but it's a pie with a lot of colors. Taking a look at a specific example like solar, citizens and farmers own almost half of all installations. And the big four energy providers that Josef mentioned own a very small portion of that pie. So what is it about the nature of renewables that make it a good fit for community development?
Renewables are very attractive to regional or local funding because unlike coal or oil or nuclear, you don't produce one big plant that supplies a huge area. But renewables are basically spread all over the place, and that is where you have to use them. So it's for solar, of course, it's much easier for you to use your roof for a solar installation than your utility to do that. To get a couple of farmers and a couple of local people together to run a wind farm is a lot simpler than getting together to run a nuclear plant, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that is part of the success, I think. This combination of a decentralized form of energy that is by necessity decentralized, plus, of course, people who are willing to come and basically take their energy future into their own hands.
So obviously these projects provide financial, there's a financial incentive there. But what are some of the other benefits that these projects provide to those individual community members and then sort of to the community as a whole?
Well, in the first place, I think for the first project, of course, the return was not really a return. We basically said in 1995, yes, you'll get your money back, but that's about it. Forget interest, forget everything else. Fortunately, of course, we then had legislation that fixed the minimum price for feeding in renewable energies onto the grid. And all of a sudden, these projects were profitable. Being economically successful is an important part of it. But of course, the pioneers were not in it for the money. They were in it to show that an alternative is possible, that it can be done, and that the stories that the utilities keep telling you that you can't do without oil, coal, or nuclear is simply not true. And I think we are making our case very much now. In fact, so much so that the German government is now stepping on the brakes to save our big coal producers.
In your experience engaging with people during the development of these projects, is there also a community building aspect to it? Are people coming together where they may not have otherwise?
Yes, very much so. We have done one project in the Black Forest, about 25 kilometers from here, and it was, of course, there was a lot of skepticism at first, but people got together and said, yes, okay, if there is participation, we'll do that. And this was, at first, it was purely a wind project. And then we organized with local people, we organized a big grand opening of that wind farm. And one of the questions people kept asking us, why did you just build two? And we said, this is a very good question. If we can get more through the planning process, we'll probably build more. And by now, this community, which is not a community of where everybody is sort of happily green, on the contrary, politically there are more conservatives there than Greens. But these people realized that we were doing a good thing, that there was no impact, no massive impact on the environment. Of course, you will always see the wind turbines. There's no way around this. If you can't see the wind turbines, something is wrong. But otherwise, the whole horror stories of noise and birds and God knows what, of course, these turned out not to be true. And so the local community accepted that, and they wanted more. And for the second project, we built a combination of wind and solar and asked many of the local people to come in and perhaps give us their roofs so we could install the solar locally. Very often the response was really interesting. Hey, that's a great idea. Love it. But you're not getting that roof.
Sure.
We're doing this ourselves. And that is indeed what happens. You can. It's. I mean, if you go to Freiamt, to this place today, it is in fact visible that there is a lot of solar there. By now, there is also biogas, so we have a nice mixture of solar, wind, and bio. Plus, of course, the community did something that people thought completely impossible before that. And we were derided by politicians, by regional local politicians, about our plans for 100% renewables for Black Forest. And by now, Freiamt does 280%. So mission accomplished.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of course, it's something that you can do basically in any rural community.
Yeah.
This is the beauty of it. This is local value creation by producing energy, by the way, something that farmers have always done. Food is energy, after all.
In my next question to Josef, I ask him about Baugemeinschaft and Verbund. Just for a little clarity beforehand, Baugemeinschaft is a community structure of building houses. So similar to a lot of what we've been talking about today, a small group of investors, often individual families, will come together, work with an architect, and build basically a small apartment building oftentimes, where everyone kind of owns a piece of that pie. Vauban is a community in Freiburg, Germany, where Josef is from, that kind of went against the grain, to say the least. It started as a military base, became a kind of a hippie paradise in a way. It was sort of an unregulated housing area, and then ultimately was sort of incorporated into the city, and a lot of their community-oriented kind of cooperative approaches were fought for to stay. And in a lot of ways, that neighborhood was successful in keeping some of those more unique ownership structures. Something I found interesting in my research into the German developments, more community-oriented developments, is things like Baugemeinschaft and what's happening in Freiburg with Vauban. And just, it seems like there's a lot of community development on a scale that isn't really comparable in the United States. Is there anything that you could sort of splice out as a reason for that community focus and for that inclusiveness? It's a hard question.
Yes, that is a hard one. But I think, of course, at the beginning, it was, as I said, sheer necessity. If you wanted to build a local wind turbine, you could probably not do this on your own because costs, of course, for a wind turbine are high. So you had to find neighbors, friends, and family, and who knows, to join you, because otherwise it couldn't be done. The same, of course, for most of the larger projects in solar that we had earlier on. So in a way, this is something by necessity. But on the other hand, there is this kind of community spirit that, of course, is there. At times, that community spirit sort of clashes with what an administration's like. I mean, you mentioned Vauban. Of course, the city of Freiburg did not think it a great idea to have all these uncontrollable community projects running around in Vauban. The original idea they had was to simply market this off to some developer or maybe a group of developers or a handful of developers. And that's that. Until, of course, a couple of local guys said, hey, maybe this is not a good idea. Maybe this is not the way we should do it. And set up an organization. And, of course, we had done some community work, community projects in Freiburg already. And in the end, of course, more or less forced the administration to concede that not all this prime land, which is almost in the center of Freiburg, should be developed by developers, but it should be done by groups. And as far as I can see, this has worked very well. It's not a new development scheme where every house looks identical. I mean, if you give such land to a developer, of course, he will build houses, and they will all be new and they will all be good looking, but they're all the same. If you give it to groups, you will not have uniformity because every group has its own idea of how what a house should look like and what materials to use, and we have that, and it's for me this is a joy. And of course, this is something, of course, if you go into villages or if you go into towns that were not destroyed in the Second World War, you will find this. So it's much more natural to develop something like that. Yes, it is also more tricky because the administration then has to deal with lots of people who have their own mind about how to do things.
This part of our conversation detracts a little bit from the focus on renewable energy. But I think it underpins potentially a really big difference between the United States and Germany. It seems like, at least in my conversations with Josef and a few others, that German citizens are really quick to mobilize themselves to make sure that their development projects reflect what they feel is best for their community. In addition to the effectiveness of the mobilization, it seems like, at least oftentimes, that these local governments respond to the demands of its citizens. If you could expand a little bit on describing why some of these projects were successful, were there, you know, just really good community frameworks already there? Was it a response to some sort of need in the community? Why have these community-oriented projects, whether that be energy or community development, why have they been successful?
I think in some cases, of course, you had strong local structures. In other cases, I've seen this in northern Germany as well. There is a community that suddenly found itself with, after the end of the Cold War, suddenly, of course, all the military people moved out of the neighborhood, and they had a huge area that was now derelict. And so they had to think about what to do. And they have developed that into an energy quarter in a way. You can't do housing there because there are all kinds of course, military relics in this area. But they developed that into a solar farm and a wind farm and a biogas plant. And this was inspired by the mayor of this place, Sarstedt. Again, a community that is now 100% plus. And of course, it has revived the debating in the community. Everybody was that's something the mayor told us in a presentation some years ago. Everybody was very depressed when the military left because that meant lots of jobs also disappeared. But they saw this as a chance and they turned this around. And I think there is something in that. And I know that kind of spirit also exists in the States. It needs a seeding point in a way to make it happen. And renewables happen to be one of these seeding points.
In your work through the process, what are some of the challenges that you've faced in implementing these projects? Some of them, just a few.
The challenges, as always, are endless.
Yeah.
I mean, if you do something new, and the guy who flew in this airplane around the world, powered by the sun, Picard, mentioned that in a statement once. If you are a pioneer, you don't expect to be loved.
Sure.
Of course, if you come to the administration saying, hey, yes, you have not, you don't have any experience with wind, but I want permission to build a wind farm, of course, they will not be very pleased with you. The same, by the way, goes for small hydro, because we've done, in FESA, we've done it all. We've done small hydro, we've done wood pellets, we've done energy saving projects, on and on and on. And so a whole variety of projects. The challenges, I mean, you have to get the permission. Very often procedures for getting that permission are not in place. You will have, of course, the banks to face. They don't know what you're doing. Of course, they are worried that they won't get their money back and things like that. So they're very cautious. Of course, you have to do all the studies that are necessary for environmental issues. That is something you have to do, of course, for renewables as well. For all renewables, it's the same. The impact is never zero. But compared to all other things we do to produce energy we need, the impact is, of course, minute. And you have to basically deal with all these issues. And, of course, here on top with the feed-in tariff and government regulation on all kinds of things, including collecting money that are sort of tightened all the time, this doesn't make things easier. Plus, in general, of course, the big, big problem that the big utilities still believe the Earth is flat. And there you go and tell them, hey, guys, perhaps maybe you should think about this. The Earth is not flat. The Earth is round. And they would say, no, 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 no. We've always done it like that, and we know it's flat. So don't even start to think about it. And then you tell them again, hey, perhaps you should think about that. I mean, the problem is, of course, if you build a boat or a big ship to circumnavigate the Earth, and someone stands next to you who believes the Earth is flat, of course, he will think you're crazy.
Yosef's analogy to the flat earthers, if you will, at this point in the conversation made me smile for sure. But I think it sort of describes the stark contrast between the motivations of community renewable developers and the status quo that that energy companies have existed in since really their conception. The concept of citizens contributing into the energy base is not something that is in any utilities, 20-year vision. At least it wasn't until recently. And so what he means by that is, you're standing next to this guy on this ship who's seeing a completely different world than you are. And the challenges are innumerable to describe to that person next to you that things are different and that the Earth is, to use his analogy, it is round.
Lots of people who thought what we were doing in solar, in wind, in small hydro, in biomass, in all these things, were absolutely mad. There are these kinds of challenges all over the place, and if you don't want to be challenged, that's perhaps not the best job for you.
Sure. That was my takeaway from, my understanding of it is that, what's happening in Germany is really a revolution in the way that energy is being produced, a fundamental change from the way it's always been produced. Craig Morris talks about energy democracy a lot in his book.
Yep.
How are these community projects more democratic for the people of the communities that are involved?
Well, first of all, of course, they're not owned by the big dinos. I like to call them dinos. They're big and strong, but we know they're going to die. They know them too. They're not just dead. They're just not dead yet. So it's owned by the people. I mean, everybody who has a roof can build solar on that roof. It's not rocket science. Panels are used to be, in fact, of course, manufactured for space flight to power satellites and stuff. So when we started, these panels were prohibitively expensive. By now, this is consumer electronics. I mean, panels do not cost the world anymore. And the profit is very simple. You put solar on your roof and you consume most of the time when the sun is shining, you consume that power. And it's you profit. And it's not some utility in a faraway place that profits from your energy consumption. And you can really, this is something, of course, that tends to be very important. Maybe that is why the farmers were involved so early. They want to do stuff themselves. So they want to produce their energy themselves. They have an energy requirement at times that is high. So they look for ways in to produce that energy. And it's, of course, something that is, I must admit, very satisfying. To know that the energy you're consuming, or at least a third of the energy you're consuming, is produced on your roof, hey, that's something. And if you just install 5 kilowatt of PV on your roof, that's about 30 square meters, that's enough to drive an electric car for 30,000 kilometers. That is, I can even power my car myself. I don't have to go to some oil company. I don't have to go to Saudi Arabia or to Russia or wherever to get the power to drive my car. I can do it on my roof. And if that's not a very democratic way of doing it, I don't know what is. It's the old Walden, the old self-reliance that, of course, comes into play here. And people want to be self-reliant. And it's very democratic if people are empowered.
And this is kind of carrying through that last question. What are you most proud of? And what advice would you give? You know, like, I mean, it's hard for me to capture it a little bit in the conversation. I'm just totally blown away by what's happening there. But, you know, what, sitting in your position now, and like you were talking about, having that solar on your roof and knowing that it's producing, you know, the power that's driving your car, I'm assuming that's probably what you're proud of. And, you know, what can we do in the United States, if you can provide a perspective, to make that happen?
Well, first of all, yes, I am proud of all that, of all the hundreds of projects that we did ourselves or we initiated. And of course, it's not just me. It's a whole group of people who did stuff like that. And it's something that is that at least gives me a good feeling. The other thing is, of course, when we started out, everybody told us this is impossible. I mean, this word, this is impossible, is something I heard over and over and over again, and it's so boring. I mean, when we started out with wind in northern Germany, they said, oh, 3% wind energy on the grid, maybe 5%, but that's anything else would just destabilize the grid and we would have blackouts and the end of the world, you know. By now, we have in northern Germany, we have on average 50% of wind on the grid. And when it's blowing, we have 100% and more on the grid. Has this been the end of the world? No, of course not. This is just normal. And only last, we have, of course, had a strong depression going through northern Germany, and we've had 80% of our electricity consumed in Germany, produced by wind alone. Hey, that's cool. Impossible? Maybe not. To see that this is, that we are now, 40 years later, that we are now technically able and at a good price to produce electricity from wind and solar and bio, to basically do 100% in Germany. And Germany is not, as you know, an agrarian society. We are a high-tech industrial country. So it's not even driving industry away. We can provide energy at a price that is compatible with what industry needs. And, of course, if we are producing it ourselves and don't have to import coal, oil, or whatever, from abroad, that is something that is helping us. And I must admit, that is indeed something that is giving me tremendously pleasant feeling when I think about it, that we are now producing 40% of our energy from renewables. And we could, if we wanted to, it's not a technical problem anymore. If we really wanted to, by 2030, we could do 100%. Were it not for the vested interests of the big utilities, of course, who still want to sell nuclear or coal or whatever. And that is perhaps the message to the states. You can do it. I mean, the spirit of innovation, look at Tesla. Fantastic. It can be done. It's just we have to put our minds to it and simply do it. And technically, this is feasible. And of course, you have to remind, sometimes you have to remind Americans that, of course, they have a lot more sun than we. We are really in the dark. I mean, particularly in, at this time of year. You have to remember that New York is as far south in Europe as Rome. This is Mediterranean. This is the sunny side of Europe. And yet we can do solar in Germany. And of course, what is stopping you? If you have a roof, what is stopping you? If you invest maybe 5,000 euro or dollar into a solar system and you produce electricity for yourself and you put another 5,000 out and then you have the power to operate your car. Done. It's easy. So dead simple that it's unbelievable. And of course, I'm at times, I'm sort of flabbergasted by that as well, that people just don't go out and do it because it is so simple by now.
Yeah.
And just do it is perhaps the best way of expressing this. Go out, clean up your car, clean up your house, and then, of course, invest in the next community wind farm that comes around. And perhaps insist on the wind farm that is being built close to you, that is not being built or should not be built by some developer from elsewhere. Do it yourself. It will generate the revenue as well for the communities. And of course, the examples you had, I've just seen this on a French documentary about urban farming in Detroit, mm-hmm. where people just empower themselves by going out and growing their own food. Fantastic. That's what we need. That's the spirit.
I think it's interesting too, just, you know, Americans identify so much with the idea of individual freedom and self-reliance as sort of a core value. But, you know, when, like you're describing, it's interesting that we don't have that right now in our energy mix or that, you know, sort of expansiveness that the German people do in that sort of grab to go out and just to get it done. So something I'm wrestling with.
Yeah, but,
yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, but remember that you have this fantastic tradition. And, of course, you also have, and we have that as well, this disease of dinosaurs that are keep telling us, we need to grow your food. We need to provide you with energy. We need to provide you with gas for your car. And we need to provide you with this, that, and the other. And these corporations are so big, and, of course, their message is on so many channels that people tend, after a while, to believe what they're saying. And perhaps one of the messages is don't believe it. Don't believe it. If they're telling you that they need to provide you with the energy for your car, tell them to get lost, because it's simply not true. You can do it. You can do that yourself.
That was Josef Pesch, a longtime advocate of community renewables and CEO of FESA, an energy cooperative in Freiburg, Germany. You know, I really love the way our conversation ended. The Energiewende, as Craig Morris pointed to, was always a people's movement. It started in the forests of Veel, Germany, and has taken the German people all the way to where they are today. As Anya Schulman pointed to, there are structural challenges in the United States that often discourage or make difficult community-based projects. But I'm a believer in Josef's spirited argument. If you have a roof, just do it. Germany wasn't a country that handed renewables to its people. It was the people who demanded it into existence. This program was hosted and produced by me, Adam Reinhardt, Music provided by Micaiah Beats. A very special thanks to Maya Jensen and Chris Harwood for their production assistance. I hope this program has provided some insight into the potential of an American Energiewende, or at the very least, revealed the power of human motivation and a spirit for change. This has been Green Visions. Thank you for listening.